Hello? Hello. Hey. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm doing the last part of Mark chapter 5, but you won't be able to see me. Yay! I think one of the first messages that Ted did on Mark, he had introduced the idea of a technique Mark used, where he started telling a story, and Mark's all about narrative, if you haven't noticed already. He starts telling a story, and then in the midst of the story, he starts telling another story, and then he finishes up the story that he started with. And scholars have called this what's across the screen there? Oh, that's my thing. Never mind. Scholars have called this a Markan intercalation, which is really, really too fancy for us. So we'll call it a Markan sandwich. And this is what this part of Mark really is. It's a Markan sandwich. Mark starts telling a story, and then in the midst of it, he starts telling this other story, and then he finishes the story that he started with. And the thing about this is that you're thinking, why would Mark interrupt himself like that? But it's a technique he uses to sort of explain the whole thing. So the middle story is sort of the key to understanding the story in which it is wrapped. So the filling explains the bread. Okay? And this is what I'm suggesting to you this morning, is how this particular story goes. So, my Galilee is cut off. I drew this myself. Well, just so you know, this is sort of how I see it in my head. What you're about to see, this is how I see it in my head. This is how I've always seen it in my head. And so when I was trying to map it out, this is how it came out. So you know my thought process. So what happens? What happened last week? Brian told us about the demon-possessed man on the other side of Lake Galilee. Lake Galilee is a fairly large lake. It's also subject, being where it is in the topography of Israel, is subject to fairly violent storms. It's a large lake, but it's not overly large. It's not like Superior or anything. But when the wind starts down, it sort of gets funneled down and it whips up very large. So the stories that we hear about storms on Lake Galilee, they're pretty, pretty serious. But anyway, in this particular instance, they made it back across the lake okay. But when they got to the other side, it says, Mark 5, that a crowd was waiting for them. And in the midst of the crowd, there was a man, Jairus, and he was the leader of the synagogue. Jairus had a problem. The problem was that his daughter, it says, was near death. Some say she was on death's door. This translation says, she's about to die, he says, in desperation. Please come and place your hands on her, heal her, so she can live. Now, this is sort of an interesting proposal when you consider who it was that was doing the asking. Jairus, and Mark's careful to point this out, he was the leader of the synagogue. Now, if you haven't already guessed, even just from reading Mark, if all you had was the Gospel of Mark, you would have known that Jesus wasn't really on really good terms with local religious folks. He did things that you weren't supposed to do, according to them. And in this story that I'm recounting right now, he actually does at least two things that he wasn't supposed to do, according to Jewish law. And so for Jairus, as sort of a spokesperson, a leader of groups that were pointing Jesus out as everything you shouldn't be as a good Jew, it's interesting that he would be showing up and asking Jesus for help. It shows the desperation at which he was at. Jesus, everybody knew that Jesus could heal people. He'd been doing this for a little while now. And everybody knew that Jesus was capable of pulling off some pretty miraculous stuff. But it's telling that Jairus, he waits until the very last minute. It's literally the last minute before he finally says, this is it. I cannot sit here and watch my daughter die. I'm going to go ask Jesus, even though he stands against everything I believe in, really. I believe that he can do it. So here he is, meeting Jesus at the seashore, at the side of the lake. He's getting off the boat, and he asks him, please come, place your hands on my daughter that she may live. It also points out the thought process that people had of what Jesus was able to do. What did he ask him to do? Come, place your hands on her that she might live. So in there, and it seems in most people's minds, Jesus actually had to do some laying on of hands. There had to be a physical touch. Now, if you were reading this, and if you're Mark's original audience, you'd probably have no problem believing that Jesus would immediately go to the house of this man who was such an important official in the town right away. Of course Jesus is going to go and heal this daughter. And I should further note that this was probably his only daughter, probably his only child. Probably. So of course Jesus would go, right? And that's what it says. Jesus immediately, he goes with him. And the crowd thronged behind. So here they are. They're heading along the road to Jairus' house. And as they're jostling along, everybody wants to see Jesus. Everybody wants to hear anything that he might have to say. They're jiggling along the road there, and all of a sudden Jesus stops. He stops, and he asks the most ludicrous question that anybody in a crowd could ever say, right? You're walking along Yonge Street on Canada Day, right? With everybody else waving the red and white, with everybody else, and you stop and you say, who touched me? Jesus does this, jostling along the street, and he stops, and he turns around and he says, who touched me? And his disciples, you can imagine what they're thinking, right? Looking at each other. What did you just say? I think he asked if anybody touched him. Who touched you? Master, we're in a crowd of people. How can you ask that question? Who touched me? Mark tells a backstory. Someone had touched him. That woman in the red, right there. She touched him. Now, what was her story? And this is the middle of the sandwich. This is the filling now. Mark starts telling us about this woman. And somebody must have gone back and done some research and said, hey, who are you? It's like the reporter, right? Something happens and nobody knows anything about the person. But they do something crazy. And of course, then the reporter shows up and says, well, who are you and where do you come from and all that sort of thing. This is sort of what Mark's doing now. He's telling the backstory. This woman had some translations call it a flow of blood. This one calls it, she'd had a hemorrhage for 12 years. A hemorrhage. Now, in every translation that you read, it's always put very nicely like this. She'd had a flow of blood. She'd had a hemorrhage. She'd been bleeding. Now, understand that what this is, okay? Understand what this woman had. She didn't have a wound that had been bleeding for 12 years. No wound bleeds that long, right? It heals up. If your blood is working correctly, it heals up within a few minutes, right? It clots and everything. What this is, and what the Bible's trying very nicely to say, was that she'd had a period. She'd been having her period for 12 years. Now, we might think, in this day and age, well, that's a problem, but manageable. Right? We have medicine. We have things to deal with such issues today. But in her day and age, there wasn't really a whole lot. And in fact, the law, as it stood in her day, wasn't really with her at all. And it says, she had suffered a great deal from many doctors. Understand? And this, I believe this is exactly how it reads. Not that she had suffered from the hemorrhaging, from the bleeding, and then had doctors try to heal her. No, she'd suffered from the doctors trying to help her. So it wasn't just the bleeding. It was bad enough, right? That she had this flow of blood that she couldn't staunch, but that she had to suffer now through treatment from doctors. Which tells us something else about her, that she probably, at one time anyway, originally had money. Because only people that had money could afford to go and see the doctors, such as they were at the time, to try and heal them. Most other people did with sort of home remedy kind of stuff. So she'd had some money, probably, and she'd suffered. She actually spent money to be abused. So whatever they'd done to her, she had suffered from it. And she had spent everything she had to pay them. So now she's destitute. And she'd gotten no better. In fact, she was worse. Leviticus chapter 15 says this. And it talks, prior to this, it talks about a woman's monthly cycle and how while she's having her period, she's unclean, and anybody that touches her will be unclean till evening, and so on and so forth. Just to be fair, men are also unclean if they have what the Bible sometimes calls a discharge. But anyway, but then after this, after the sort of the regular monthly period thing, the Bible says this. When a woman has a discharge of blood for many days at a time, other than her monthly period, or has a discharge that continues beyond her period, she'll be unclean as long as she has the discharge, just as in the days of her period. Any bed she lies on while her discharge continues will be unclean, as is her bed during her monthly period, and anything she sits on will be unclean as during her period. Anyone who touches them will be unclean. They must wash their clothes and bathe with water, and they will be unclean till evening. If this is making you feel a little squeamish and perhaps a little embarrassed, think of how she must have felt for the last 12 years. Just for a second, think about it. So, can she go to synagogue? And this is sort of an interesting part. Here we are on the way to a synagogue leader's house. And we have a woman in the crowd who hasn't seen the inside of a synagogue for 12 years because she can't be with the people of God. She's unclean, according to the law. If she touches anyone, they will be unclean. And understand, this is ritually unclean, which is a little different from being actually unclean. But by this point, Judaism was such that even being ritually unclean was to be as avoided as being dirty. It was a big deal for Jews in her day and age to be ritually unclean. So for her to even think about touching anybody or going into a crowd was a pretty big deal. And for her to consider touching a rabbi was huge. Understand what she had to go through, the thought process, in order to even get to where she was. in a crowd to even touch the hem of Jesus' robe. It was a pretty big deal, because if Jesus was the type of man, like most men were in Israel at the time, to say, "Ew, you touched me, now I'm unclean till evening, you've totally ruined my day," she'd be further embarrassed, right? And further ostracized, even more than she was, if that was even possible. That would be really catastrophic, really bad day, if that happened, if Jesus was that type of guy. But she had heard about Jesus, so she came up behind him through the crowd, and she touched the fringe of his robe, for she thought to herself, "If I can just touch his clothing, I will be healed." And when she touched his clothing, immediately the bleeding stopped, and she could feel that she had been healed. That's interesting. She knew right away. I guess when you live with something for so long, you know when something is different, right? Anyway, she's healed. And her expectation would have been that she would just let the crowd continue and she would go home. But Jesus, he feels that power has gone out of him. And this is an interesting concept. I thought about this for a little bit, and I can't explain it. How did Jesus know that power had gone out of him? I don't know. But it seems that Jesus feels when faith has been utilized, when his power has been called upon, even when nobody else knows, even when nobody says anything. Jesus knows. And my question, sort of sitting in the back of my head, which I'm not going to answer, is, does this happen all the time when we have a bit of faith and we trust in him for something? Does power come out of him? Interesting question. Anyway, some thoughts about this. 5. Oh, I'm jumping ahead actually a little bit. Jesus realized at once that healing power had gone out from him. So he turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" And of course his disciples said, "You're crazy." But he kept on looking around to see who had done it. And the woman realized the gig was up, right? She's not getting away with it. Somehow he knows. He knows that I touched him. He knows that I've been healed. So she made herself known. She didn't run away. She, trembling at the realization of what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and told him what she had done. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. You have been healed." Now, my question is, why did Jesus bother? Why did he make a big deal of it? Because even if he could have felt, and he did feel, even if he felt that power had gone out of him and knew that someone had been healed, why not just keep going? Right? Jairus' daughter is at the point of death. Time is of the essence. Jairus is probably like there by his elbow. You know, as you do, let's go, hurry on. But he stops and he makes a big deal about this. Why? Why would Jesus make a big deal about this woman touching him in secret? Nobody had to know. Wouldn't this embarrass her further? You can make a point for that, I think. And initially, I think she probably was fairly embarrassed, but she came forward anyway. But here's what I'm thinking. Jesus knows that what we need, what all of us need, is not just physical healing. Think about what this woman had been through for the last 12 years of her life. It wasn't just physical suffering. She had suffered in a lot more ways than just a flow of blood. It's very possible that she had probably been married, and it's possible, very possible, that she was now divorced. Because as a Jewish man, her husband would have been unclean, even touching her. And men, in a Jewish context, You'd like to think they would have stuck by their wives in such a situation, but many of them wouldn't. And no mention is made of her husband, and my thought is that he had divorced her at some point, which would have left her totally destitute, no one to care for her. Who knows how she had been living? I have no idea how she had been living for as long as she had, just getting her daily bread. She had suffered much more than from a physical ailment. Jesus knows this about each one of us. When we come to him for healing, what he really wants, he does want us to give us physical healing. But more importantly, I think, to the Lord, is that we are healed spiritually. And so here are the thoughts. First of all, he calls her daughter. You know why this is significant? Because in the Gospels, Jesus only ever calls one woman daughter ever, and it's this woman. He may have called other women daughter, but it's not recorded. The only recorded instance of Jesus calling a woman daughter is this woman here. And my thinking, again, who's standing by Jesus' elbow? Jairus, whose daughter is up the road, dying. And I think what this is Jesus sort of letting those that were listening and Jairus know that he cared as deeply about this unknown woman as Jairus cared about his daughter. Not only that, but it told the woman how deeply he loved and cared for her. His purpose wasn't to call her out and embarrass her, but to heal her wholly, not just the problem she'd been suffering, but her whole being. Your faith has made you well. Faith. Faith? Faith? This is interesting. How much faith did she have? How much faith did Jairus have? We are very big in our evangelical circles about faith. Some of us have the idea that stuff doesn't happen because we don't have enough faith, that we need huge amounts of faith in order for God to be able to rumble into action. But when you look at a story like this, how much faith was going on? From what I can see, there was really hardly any at all. It was a spark, a slight spark. This woman, she'd been suffering for 12 years. And who knows what it had taken for her even to get to where, into that crowd. And Jairus, leader of the synagogue, the last person in the world that he probably wanted help in his daughter, and yet he managed to scrape up some little spark, this little bit of faith, and he presented it to Jesus, and Jesus was able to do something with that. Isn't that crazy? But Jesus said it himself, even if you have faith as small as a mustard seed. Let's get this idea out of our heads that we need buckets and buckets of faith in order for God to do anything. God, Jesus, he's able to do great things with smidgens of faith. Your faith has made you well. This word is not a word in the original. It's not the word that you would use to say that you've been healed from a physical ailment. You'd use other words. The words that Jesus is using is more like your faith has saved you. And it encompasses not just physical, but spiritual healing as well. So what he's saying is that faith that you've presented to me in touching the hem of my garment, it's not just healed you physically. You now have the opportunity to be healed completely, your entire spiritual being. He uses the same word in Luke when the woman who was a known sinner, read prostitute, came and anointed his feet. And Jesus says, your faith has saved you. She had no physical ailment that we know of, but he used that same word, and he uses it here. It's an all-encompassing healing. And that's what Jesus is really interested in, isn't it? He's not just interested in our physical well-being. I think he's really more interested in where we're going to spend eternity, what our relationship is to him. Go in peace. Would that have been possible if he had just allowed her to touch the edge of his robe and allowed her to disappear into the crowd? Would she have been at peace? I don't think she would. She would have just been healed. And that's pretty significant. But if you're not healed spiritually, if you're not right with the Creator, nothing is really right. And she probably hadn't heard this phrase spoken to her in quite some time. I think the priests were supposed to say it after her sacrifice was made. But she hadn't been to sacrifice anything for a long time because she was unclean. Be freed from your suffering. Jesus is not talking about her physical suffering. The word used for suffering here can also be used for scourging. And when you think about, if you can try and imagine what she had been through for the last 12 years, that's what Jesus is freeing her from. That inner turmoil, that the sense of loss of being cut off from her people, from her family, from everything. Be freed from that, he says. This is what I believe Jesus made a big deal about this. Because now she could go now with a light heart. Not only had her faith, small as it was, healed her physically, but now Jesus had just put her back together again and sent her on her way. Go in peace. So, now, they finally, well, they're getting to Jairus' house. But before they get there, people show up from Jairus and they say, your daughter has just died. Why bother the teacher anymore? So again, we're seeing insight into what they're thinking, right? What was the general thinking? In order for Jesus to be able to heal anybody, he'd have to physically lay hands on them, right? And now that the daughter was dead, if Jesus, as a Jewish man, or as a Jewish anybody, was to put his hands on a dead object, he'd be unclean. Then what was the point? Right? What was the point now? And that's why they showed up. So that Jesus wouldn't have to be faced with having to touch or even look on a dead body. But Jesus ignored their comments and he said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid. Just trust me." So they show up at the house and everybody is wailing and causing a commotion. I think this tells us something about how sick she really was. In Israel, at the time, they hired people to come to funerals and be professional mourners. I know this sounds really weird, But that's what they did. People would show up, they'd hire them, and they'd make a big commotion. Because the louder the commotion, the more it was seen that you were really, really grieving, right? For your lost loved one. My guess is that she was so near death that these people had basically already been hired. It was inevitable. So they were there, sort of on retainer, ready to start wailing as soon as she died. So it seems that she'd been sick, very near sick, for quite some time. So there they were, and Jesus is trying to get through this. And he's saying, "Why? Why are you crying? She's not dead. She's only sleeping." Well, of course, if she's only sleeping, that means that they're not going to get their money. So they laughed at him. But he shooed them all out, kept only three friends and the parents, walks in, takes the little girl, the dead girl, by the hand, thus making himself unclean. Just like the woman touching him would have made him unclean. And he says to her, "Talitha kumi." Why Mark uses the Aramaic, I don't know. He does explain it, but I'm still trying to figure out why he put that in there. But all it means is, "Little girl, get up." At one point, I saw that some scholars had actually thought that Jesus was calling her Tabitha. That was her name, but that's not what it means at all. It just means, "Little girl, get up." And she got up immediately and started walking around. Now, some people would look at this story and say, well, she was only sleeping. Someone just needed to give her a good shake. But everything that you read here sort of flies in that. One, they were astonished that she did get up. They're astonished. So they weren't expecting the people, you know, you gotta trust that people aren't stupid. And they didn't really expect her to get up because she was so sick. And then she'd been sick some time, and that not just that she opened her eyes and was revived again and then got better, but that she immediately got up and was walking around. And oh, by the way, she was 12. What? She was 12? Wait a second. 12. Did we hear 12 somewhere else in the story? Was there some other instance where... Oh, yeah. The woman that Jesus had healed on the way there, she'd had this flow of blood for 12 years. Is this a coincidence? No. Mark put that in there for a reason. He's just wrapping, that's like the top of the sandwich, right? He's just like lovingly, he started out with that bottom slice of bread, and he made sure that it was well buttered, and then well mayonnaised, and then well mustarded, right? And then he started laying on that, on the layers of the ripe tomato and the crispy lettuce, and that slice of ham and bacon? Sure, bacon. Right? And now he's putting it all together and that other well-buttered slice of bread on top. 12. But she was 12. It all comes together. And Mark, if you think that this is a coincidence, please stop right now. Mark, when he writes stuff like this, he's making a point. His point is, I think, is that Jesus cares just as much for the daughter of a very important, wealthy synagogue leader as he does for this unknown, unclean, ostracized woman of Israel. And there's probably a few other things you could throw in there. I've read commentaries on how the 12 represents the 12 tribes, and there's the church and the old Jewish nation and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just trying to take this at face value here. What was Mark trying to say? Don't be afraid, Jesus said. What was he afraid of? His daughter was dead. How much worse can it get? Don't be afraid. It seems that fear is sort of a direct antithesis to faith. It's hard to have faith when you're afraid. The kingdom of heaven, fear gets in the way of the kingdom of heaven advancing. And you hear that again and again in the Gospels. Kingdom of heaven. Jesus is here to advance the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven seemed to be both present and future. And Jesus was, he was forwarding both at the same time. The kingdom of heaven now, kingdom of heaven in the future. But fear seemed to stand in the way of that. What was Jairus afraid of? Perhaps that Jesus couldn't heal a dead girl? Perhaps that Jesus wouldn't go and even try? Perhaps that everything that his faith that he'd had that got him to the seashore was for nothing. But he says, don't be afraid. I think that's one of the more key phrases in this entire story. Jesus says, don't be afraid. Faith has a hard time getting any ground when there's fear. And I've already gone on at a bit of length about 12 years. Interesting story, yeah? Jesus is not just worried or concerned about physical healing. He's not just concerned about people dying. The faith that caused that, that brought that woman to touch the hem of his cloak was the same kind of faith that drove Jairus to humble himself, really, no matter what it looked like to everybody else in the synagogue or the other religious leaders, and throw himself at Jesus' feet and say, please come and heal my little girl, my only little girl. And Jesus came. He came. And not only did he heal and raise from the dead, but he brought healing in a more profound, full, and whole way. That's the kind of healing that we can expect from Jesus on a day-to-day basis. But fear stands in the way of that. Let's pray. Father, we just thank you for your word. We thank you for Jesus. We thank you for the stories that have been told of him. Sometimes we take a little digging, a little ferreting out. But Lord, that's sort of the enjoyment of it. I'm trying to understand what happened a few thousand years ago. Help us, as we muse on this, to more fully understand yourself, your motives, your methods. We thank you for the things that we can seem to see clearly. We just pray that you help us understand the things that we can't quite see so clearly. Help us to understand you, to grow closer to yourself. Help us to banish fear from our lives, that we might have more and more faith. Because it seems, Lord, that you can use even just a little bit. Thank you for the time spent in your word this morning. We thank you for each one that's here. We thank you for the fellowship that we can share together. In Jesus' name, amen.